and staring me in the face, which is why I didn't see it. Basically, in normal, this is very loud, in normal coordinates, your variation of the Ricci tensor is given just by varying these derivatives of the connection, because the other terms have two gammas. So a variation of two gammas would be gamma delta gamma, which is zero in normal coordinates. So you simply get the partial derivatives of delta gamma. However, delta gamma, sorry, could the audio visual person maybe just do something? This feels like I'm in an echoing cave. Delta gamma is in fact a tensor. A difference of connections is a tensor. So in normal coordinates, thanks, comma goes to semicolon, partial derivatives are equivalent to covariant derivatives. And so this expression here is the same as the line above in normal coordinates. However, this expression is actually covariant because we've got the covariant derivative and a tensor. So that's okay. Then we focus in on delta gamma. And again, in normal coordinates, the first derivatives of the metric vanish. So in normal coordinates, the variation of delta gamma just depends on partial derivatives of delta g. But in normal coordinates, I send partial to covariant. And then by the time I've got here, that's also a covariant expression. And then you insert that in the other line and you get the expression I wrote down. So that's I guess, a completely watertight explanation. Okay, so today I want to talk about I'm sort of building up this set of solutions or interesting gravitational solutions. And today I want to talk about non-perturbative solutions in gravity. So we talked about field theories yesterday, looked at Lagrangians, how to integrate on the manifold, and how we do the variational principle, and how the square root of g is included in the variational principle. And today, I want to look at some non-trivial matter solutions. So usually, when you're doing field theory, you're doing perturbation theory. You're looking at perturbative solutions. You tend to want to quantize and look at the particle states. However, it's also possible that even within the field theory, you have some non-trivial, non-perturbative solutions. And since most of what we look at in gravity, like the black hole or cosmology, is also non-perturbative, I want to look at sort of these two things going on together. So I'm going to just start with looking at my scalar field, a real scalar field, and I'm going to consider a potential which is a double well potential. So here's my V. So normally when you first meet this potential, this is a sort of candidate example of spontaneous symmetry breaking. You choose a vacuum and you quantize around the vacuum and you see that you're just left with some massive scalar. In this case, the symmetry is a Z2 symmetry. Phi goes to minus phi. But instead, I want to consider the situation where all the way over here, phi is minus eta on the left-hand side of the board, and all the way over here on the right-hand side of the board, phi is plus eta. So, in other words, phi has to interpolate between minus and plus eta. So I'm imagining there's an infinite region of space over, I'm just ignoring gravity for the moment, an infinite region of space all the way to the right where phi is plus eta in one vacuum, and all the way over here on the left, phi is in the minus vacuum. So by continuity, phi's got to get from here to here, so it's got to move through phi equals zero. So somewhere in the middle, I'm going to have energy density. So this is a sort of example of something known as a domain wall, because it's a wall because that's what it looks like to us, and it bounds regions of different vacua. Or separates, I think, is the correct word, rather than bounds. So sometimes the phrase domain wall also gets used to mean something which interpolates between different vacua. So that's another context. But the idea is that you've got on one side a sort of vacuum-type solution, on the other side a vacuum-type solution, and there's something happening in between. So if I look at the phi equation of motion, again, for the moment, I'm just ignoring gravity. So it's my wave equation. And this translates to should put a coupling constant there. So I'm going to assume that my interpolation function just depends on that distance from left to right. And that's my equation of motion. It's actually got an analytic solution. Which is the tangent function. So we have something roughly like this for phi. And so the idea is that the region over which phi is varying is depending on lambda and eta, but it's, I guess we sort of intuitively think of it as being relatively small, but you can see that it's defined by the mass of the scalar excitations around the vacuum. So that's the mass of the scalar is what's setting the sort of width of the wall. So just to note this equation of motion, it actually has a first integral. In other words, my sort of kinetic energy or gradient energy is actually equal to the potential energy in this particular case. So what that means is my energy momentum tensor is actually quite straightforward. So I'll just write down what TAB is in this case. I simply, sorry, such to the fourth. I've written down what phi prime does there, not what phi prime squared is. So I see I've got a very simple energy momentum tensor, and if I just sort of sketch what it looks like, it's very, very strongly peaked around x equals zero. And so again, it has this width, which is 1/√λ/eta. So it's strongly localized. And the other feature of it is that the sort of transverse energy momentum vanishes, at least in this flat space limit. And what remains, the parallel components of the energy momentum, are proportional to the metric along the wall. Energy momentum vanishes. So G at the metric along the wall. So in this case, that's just the Minkowski metric, but I'm giving these automatic ones a try today, see if I don't get completely tied in knots. Yes, it's the energy density, but that's the same as TYY and TZZ. Perhaps it's worth pointing out that TYY is minus PY, the pressure in the Y direction. So that means that the pressure is actually negative, and so we've got a tension in both the Y and the Z directions, which is equal in magnitude to the energy density. So this type of energy momentum is something which is very typical of what we call in general brains. So brain coming from, rather than calling this a wall, calling it a membrane, something extended. So that's just, this is known, or rather the one-dimensional solution is known as the lambda phi to the fourth kink. It's a well-known example of a what's inaccurately called a soliton in field theory. It's also known as a topological defect. The thing is, you can't remove this. This is, if you like, a third vacuum state of the theory. Because if you tried to get rid of it, you'd have to take the field. Let's say you wanted to throw everything in the minus vacuum. You'd have to take the field in an infinite region of space and lift it over that potential barrier in the middle. And so that costs an infinite amount of energy. And so that means it's dynamically stable. And it's called topological defect because it's the topology of this vacuum manifold that's protecting it from decay. So that's sort of a well-known object in field theory. But what about gravity? So this wall has a finite energy per unit area. So we can integrate up the energy density across the wall. So it's finite energy per unit area, but it's got an infinite area. So we might expect this to have a very strong gravitational effect. So I'm just going to give you a sort of plausibility argument for the type of metric I'm going to write down. In reality, it was found more by trial and error. But the energy momentum tensor here being proportional to the metric in the parallel directions of the wall suggests a constant curvature space. So it's a bit like cosmology. In cosmology, we have a completely isotropic fluid source in our sort of spatial sections of the universe, and we also have this notion of homogeneity and isotropy. I'm just going to say that there's nothing here from the field theory that suggests that the space-time parallel to the wall would be anything other than homogeneous and isotropic. So it's going to turn out to be one of our warped compactifications. Oh, I don't mean to call it gamma. But I'm going to say that this is actually a constant curvature space. I'm going to say this is de Sitter space. And so, as I said, that was found by trial and error. So we can read off our curvature because we computed it for that metric. So what I've done here, remember in our warped compactification example, I've just written down what the RR component is, but the mu nu pieces have terms proportional to the derivatives of the warp factor, so I've just put D equals 4 there. And then there's a piece which is proportional to the curvature of this background gamma. And so in this case, if this is the de Sitter metric, then R naught alpha beta is simply minus 2 over L squared gamma alpha beta, where L is just the length scale. So if you were in, I guess this would be, or maybe I should have put minus 2 H squared if that makes people happier. It's basically the expansion rate of that de Sitter universe. So what we should be doing, of course, in general, is writing down our full coupled Einstein and scalar field. Yep. L. I'm sorry? L squared A squared? L is the length scale of the de Sitter space. So that's what I was just saying, that it's the length scale of the de Sitter space. Or if I'd written instead of 2 on L squared, I could have written 2H squared, where H would be like the Hubble constant. But I keep sort of saying things with analogy to cosmology, but I guess your cosmology course is not yet. It's like saying that a two-sphere, the metric on a two-sphere is proportional to the d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. But if the two-sphere has radius a, you'd have an a squared in front of that, and the curvature would look like 1 on a squared times an appropriate factor, which would be dimension dependent. So that's where it's coming from. It's the sort of like the size of the de Sitter space, the curvature scale. Okay? Well, that's because it just depends on x, because I said that on the left, when x is negative, phi is negative, roughly speaking. When x is positive, phi is positive. It doesn't depend on y and z. So that's why t naught naught is the same as tyy and tzz, because there's no y or z dependence. It's like a symmetry of the solution. And the only thing that I've done, which I said was based on this trial and error, is that you might initially just write down literally dt squared minus dx squared minus dy squared for that sort of parallel part of the metric. But it was found that that just didn't work, okay? And you shouldn't be surprised in a sense that it doesn't work, because as I say, although the wall has finite energy per unit area, it has infinite area. So we're expecting something, you know, reasonably dramatic to happen. And I guess another piece of slightly flaky intuition would be that if you thought about this setch to the fourth function as being an approximation to a delta function, then you would say that your parallel components of the energy momentum were just something that was just located on a surface and proportional to the metric. And that looks awfully like a cosmological constant. And a cosmological constant gives you de Sitter space. So that's sort of another kind of hand-waving way of motivating why I put de Sitter for that gamma metric. Is going to become R, yes. Yes, yes. So I'm not really labeling those coordinates. I'm just hiding them away. But I've now, simply I used R, I think, when I wrote that down. I used it that exact format. So that's why I'm using it here. So ideally, we'd like to have a sort of complete nonlinear solution, but at least as a starting point, and one that actually proves to be extremely accurate, what we're going to do is to notice that in our Einstein equations, this this is going to be equal to 8 pi g trr minus a half t. And we know that the functions appearing here, because of the energy density, are going to be looking like 8 pi g eta squared times lambda eta squared times this function of r, which is strongly peaked. So this term here is just telling us about the width of this object. But this term here is telling us about the coupling to gravity. So here, 8 pi g eta squared is essentially eta over the Planck mass squared. And so unless we have a field that is where we're talking about its symmetry breaking scale being at the Planck scale, we can safely assume that this number is small. So I'm going to assume that that number is small, and I'm going to do basically a sort of bootstrap, a step-by-step approach to solving for the gravitational equations. I'm going to assume well, in reality, I say solve order by order. You could, if you were sort of on a desert island with pen and paper. But in reality, you just bung it on a computer and sort of integrate it up and see what it looked like. And so, indeed, the analytic first order step that I'm going to take now does actually give you an excellent approximation to the exact solution, even for, you know, as epsilon starts approaching one. So our Einstein equations okay, so the first thing to note is that if I look at the GRR equation, it's telling me that this combination of the first derivative of a squared and the 1 over L squared actually vanishes, and that vanishes everywhere. Whereas the TT equation tells me that outside the wall, A double primed is roughly zero, and through the wall, A double primed is negative. So those two pieces of information already tell me roughly what my solution is going to look like. The top one, or the two, tells me that, roughly speaking, my A primed is going to be a constant, and if A double primed is negative, I know it's going to look, if I exaggerate, something like this. So this would be the wall region, and outside the wall region, so A primed is roughly minus one on L there. So that's just as a sketch what I'm expecting for that warp factor. But if I just want to find it more precisely, I put my, so I'm saying now, again, I'm doing everything to order epsilon. To leading order, A is just one, we're in flat space. So my A double primed is just order epsilon. And it's something like this. I can integrate that up to give me A primed, again, being of order epsilon. I think I've done the integrations right. So that gives me, if you look at what I've written down here, the hyperbolic cosine at large r just simply looks like e to the root lambda eta r. And so I'm getting at positive r, I get simply here 2/3 epsilon root lambda eta r. At negative r, it'll pick out the negative bit, so it gives me the right 1 plus 2/3 epsilon for negative r. And then the middle piece tells me that A primed, if A primed is minus 1 on L outside, if I look over here for large r, I can see that my L is then simply, so A primed is minus 2/3 epsilon root lambda eta. So that tells me what my L is. So it's a very, since that 1 over L is small, it tells me that the radius of curvature of the de Sitter space is very large. So it's not, in general, it's sort of not a strongly curved space. But let's just look a bit closer, because if this is my A, or my A is roughly 1 minus R on L, that means I've got a horizon. But actually, sorry, plus or minus L, it's 1 over. This could be a singularity, but in fact it is a horizon, as I've said. So this is a true horizon. It's not a singular, not a singularity. And in fact, what I've written down, if you think just again as a sort of just a slightly hand-waving justification, remember the Rindler space I wrote down? The Rindler space that was simply just in a TX direction where the observer was accelerating in the X direction with uniform acceleration, that looked like something like rho squared d tau squared minus d rho squared, okay? And so at large R, you're seeing something similar here, R squared times a sort of de Sitter piece minus dr squared. So that's kind of justifying that what you've really got is a coordinate transformation of flat space. So that's slightly peculiar, but in fact, what we have is simply a coordinate transformation. This is our wall, if I can choose a different color so that it hopefully... So this is meant to be, the orange is meant to be a light cone. So what the wall is a hyperboloid in four-dimensional flat space. This is our wall, which is R equals zero. The light cone is at R equals one on L. And so that's very like the de Sitter situation. But the only thing that's different is, so here we've got R greater than zero. The only thing that's weird is actually, if I go to negative R, I'm not going the other side of the hyperboloid. I'm actually taking a copy of my space. So we kind of glue these two together. So it's not, this is sort of a slightly difficult thing to when you first come across it, to kind of get around. But basically what I wrote down here was something that was symmetric under interchange of R and minus R, just like the domain wall was symmetric under swapping left and right, the potential symmetric under swapping phi and minus phi. My space-time has to be symmetric under going from R to minus R. So what that means is I've got two copies of this hyperboloid, which if the wall were infinitesimally thin, I'd just glue straight together. In reality, there's a sort of smooth transition. We're not in vacuum quite at the wall, and that sort of takes us through from here to its mirror image. But it's an example where if we look at the spatial part that sliced through here at t equals constant, we've actually got a compact space. So we have something that looks kind of like sort of burger bun or something, where you've got two huge flat round regions and they join together as they sort of fold over from top to bottom. So the sides of your burger bap are curved, and that corresponds to this Ricci curvature here, which is where the wall is. So this is our curved region. So it's like Rindler space. You can see the ingredients. And the other curious thing is, so if I look at things from the wall's perspective, everything looks quite curved and, you know, a lot of particles' trajectories, geodesics would look bent. But if I look at it from the perspective of the bulk, i.e. away from the wall, I'm in Minkowski space, So my observers are simply straight, my inertial observers are just straight world lines here. So they may do this. And so what that tells me is, if I look at this, this is something an observer is, from the perspective of the wall, is constantly accelerating away from the wall. So remember I said about energy conditions yesterday, about the strong energy condition implying the attractiveness of gravity. The domain wall violates the strong energy condition, and it looks like it's repelling observers. So the trajectory of an inertial observer will accelerate away from the wall. So what we've done here is we've looked at and we've looked at a solution to a field theory in space-time. We've looked at a non-perturbative style of field theory solution, one of these topological defects. We've coupled it to gravity. So here's an example, very nearly at least. I've only done it sort of approximately analytically, but you can do it exactly if you wish. Here's an example where we've got an exact solution in gravity involving extra fields. It's although it's flat in the bulk, it's highly non-trivial. You've got sort of compactification of your spatial sections. And these domain walls, in this case, I've just sort of shown a very sort of idealized solution. It's in otherwise empty space. But the concept of the domain wall, it turns out that you can, in a precise way, take some finite width object, which has just one extra dimension, like the wall, and approximate it with an infinitesimally thin object. So this sort of will lead us to something, you know, called Israel's equations, which we'll come back to later. But it's also used, so domain walls crop up. People think about them in the context of cosmology, because in the early universe, you have all sorts of, you know, potentials with complicated vacuum manifolds. You have situations with symmetry breaking. You may need to worry about what happens if you get domain walls. So typically, domain walls are not good news cosmologically. You use them also, I said, they interpolate between regions of different vacua. In this case, what I've done is something where I've had a very symmetric situation. I've written down something with Z2 symmetry, both the potential and the space-time. You don't have to have that sort of symmetry, R goes to minus R, even if you've got Z2 in your underlying vacuum manifold. You can find different sorts of solutions. You can also interpolate between different types of vacua. So I could have a case where I've got de Sitter space on one side, flat space on the other side. And that would be, for example, nucleation of a bubble of vacuum inside of de Sitter space. So the domain wall type of formalism gets used in models where, say, inflation ends by a first order phase transition, so through tunneling. So this type, or this candidate solution here, crops up all over the place. And then, of course, as I say, in a different context, as in interpolating between different vacuum solutions, people use the term domain wall to represent a situation where you're flowing from one type of vacuum solution to your Einstein equations to another. So this concept seems to come up all over the place.
I don't think that people have seen perturbative solutions before.
Non-perturbative ones.
When you said you solve order by order, maybe it's worth just repeating for 1 second what you mean by that.
So it's like what you really want is a full solution, to the not just the gravitational equations I've written down, but also to the full curved space wave operator. So the only way adding in this metric changes that phi equation of motion at the top is that it adds an extra piece, which is, I'll just bring it down and sort of indicate it here. You'd have something coming from the A term. So it would be minus, I guess, 3 A primed on A phi primed in there. So that stops that from having its simple first integral. But if I look at the equation for the warp factor A, it's dependent on the energy momentum, which has this factor of epsilon in it. So if I look at my my equation for phi, the correction I get from the curved geometry comes in at the order of g eta squared. So if my g eta squared is small, it's a reasonable thing to say, okay, so I'm going to write phi is equal to phi naught plus epsilon phi 1, etc. And I'm going to write my a is a naught plus epsilon a 1. And then if I just write that and look in the equations of motion, I see that phi naught satisfies the flat space, so the Minkowski space equations of motion. A naught is just my Minkowski space. And then I can see I can consistently go order by order in epsilon, solving for phi 1 a 1, phi 2 a 2, and so on and so forth. I mean, it rapidly becomes analytically messy, but at least, you know, it's something that it makes sense to do. And once you sort of look more generally, or you explore phase space numerically, looking sort of at all values of epsilon, you see that at least below a certain value of epsilon, this approach is completely straightforward. So the only thing that can snag you is if epsilon gets too big, then you find, well, obviously the perturbative expansion is no go, but you find that you can't actually support going from one vacuum to the other. And so basically the thing will just coherently roll, but then you're well into the Planck regime and you wouldn't really believe what you were doing anyway. So that's the... Because A goes to zero. Because A is roughly 1 minus R on L. Well, A primed is plus or minus 1 on L, just from that first GRR equation. And so that I just integrate that up once, and then my background A is 1. So I've got 1 plus or minus R and L, and then I decide which branch it is by looking at the fact that A double primed is negative. So I drew my sketch before writing down the solution based on knowing that A primed had to be constant, but I didn't know what sign. And then the fact that A double primed has to be negative fixes for me the fact that it's a maximum. So that's what then tells me, well, I've got to go from the plus gradient to the minus gradient. So that's how I then decide which is which. And so you kind of see that all over in general, with any dimension, with brain type solutions, is that the positive energy density of the wall tells you you're going from this region of an increasing warp factor to a decreasing warp factor. So that was the input I used there before I went ahead and solved it.
And why did you draw the I equals 1 over L light cone?
Oh God, I've done it as 1 over L. I think it's because I normally use, should be R equals L. I think it's because I normally use K. I normally use an inverse length, and I'm just forgetting. So I think that's all
the
it
horizon,
is.
Essentially. That's the light cone.
So the light cone is the horizon, and you can see that because by analogy with the Rindler horizon.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and in fact, those that have sort of played around with de Sitter space will know that actually you can represent de Sitter space as a hyperboloid embedded in one dimension higher flat space. So I'm going to have to sort of zip through the next bit a bit. So that's an example of what we call a co-dimension one solution, which means there's one direction. So an example of a co-dimension two. Which is more physically relevant, or at least it gets used more, you get an example of codimension two from the Abelian-Higgs model. So here, remember, we have a complex scalar, it's charged, and it has a non-trivial vacuum manifold. So this is our toy Higgs model. And the vacuum manifold has a U1 symmetry. So hopefully you've seen this in field theory, and you know that when you quantize around one or any particular vacuum on this circle, what would have been a zero mode or a massless particle going around the bottom, a sort of scalar zero mode, gets absorbed by the vector and becomes a massive vector boson. And so you can see that by rewriting your field content in such a way that the phase of phi is explicitly absorbed, and so you have an effective Lagrangian. So I've just now said that F is really dp here. So I've kind of redefined it. Maybe I should put a twiddle over this one just to emphasize it's different. Mm-hmm. So here, this kind of makes explicit the physical degrees of freedom in the theory. You've got a real scalar F, and then your vector field P is now massive if F is non-zero. So that's kind of explicitly rewriting it so that you have a massive vector and a massive scalar. But what we want to do is to not just, we're not really interested actually in the particle excitations. We want to look at something similar to the situation here where we have some non-trivial map between space and our vacuum manifold. Our vacuum manifold here is a circle. So what we want to do, if I look at a plane, which I'm going to do in polar coordinates, we want to have the phase of our Higgs field completely winding around the vacuum manifold. Now, you might think, isn't that just a gauge transformation? There's no content there. But that's not true, because if you wanted to get rid of this phase by a gauge transformation, you'd have to do it by the function theta, so that you would be taking from your gauge field d theta. But d theta has a singularity, so it's not actually defined globally on the plane. So it's not something that you can actually do everywhere. And so this, although it almost completely encodes the physical information, the one thing that you've got to just keep in the back of your mind is that's the physical content, except I could have isolated singularities where I have winding of my Higgs field. So we're going to look for a solution where my phi is going to be F e to the I theta. And I'll just, for convenience, pull out the factor of the symmetry breaking scale, and that my P mu is also going to be just dependent on theta. So the reason I want to have a P is because I need to be able to make my gauge field non-singular at the origin, and so I have to have some component of my massive vector field switched on. So this gives me a set of equations. I'm just going to write them down so that at least you can see them. So within this, you can sort of see that if my x is non-zero, it's giving a mass to the p. And these, unfortunately, don't have an analytic solution, but they're not too difficult to integrate. And so you end up with something looking roughly like this. So this is the x, this is the p. The effective width of the x is, once again, 1 over root lambda eta, but the effective width of the P can be slightly different, which is 1 over eta E in terms of the parameters. And so once again, the widths of each of these components, the width of the scalar part is given by the inverse Higgs mass, the width of the vector part is given by the inverse boson mass. So it sort of tallies. It's the same idea that the width of the wall was given by the inverse scalar mass. So it's the same same structure. Mm-hmm. So one is WH, the top one is WH representing the Higgs width. That's 1 over root lambda eta. You're right, they are quite small. So if I rewrite this one, this is the 1 over eta E. So that's the width. Oh, I've put it as P. It's the width of the gauge boson. So what you have here is a very sharply confined vortex. So it's a vortex, kind of looks linear, pointing in the z direction. And because we've got P is P of R d mu theta, that gives us an F R theta, which is sort of equivalent if we were to interpret it in electromagnetic terms to a BZ. And so this looks like a sort of magnetic flux pointing up the Z-axis. So in fact, in superconductivity, you usually model, you tended to model superconductivity by a massive, but giving the photon a mass. And so if in that context, this would describe, in an effective theory of superconductivity, a confined magnetic vortex inside a superconductor. So it's the same sort of set of nonlinear equations. But in our context here, we're looking at a particular quantum field theory model. It's only a simple illustrative model of the Higgs mechanism, but nonetheless, it's something which illustrates symmetry breaking. We're imagining that maybe this is occurring at something like a grand unified scale, but it's, again, protected by topology. If we wanted to get rid of it, we'd have to unwind it in an infinite region of space. And so it's potentially got a large energy density. So again, we've got mu, which is proportional to eta squared, which is the energy per unit length. And that's set by the symmetry breaking scale. So for everyday terms, it's potentially huge. So I just want to quickly sketch what happens when you add gravity. And I'm just going to simplify by saying that if I set E squared as lambda, so I'm sort of saying that the widths of the two cores are roughly equal, then I get a simplification of my equations of motion. Which I'm just going to use to make my energy momentum tensor look simple. So for the energy momentum, T naught naught is TZZ. Again, we've got this factor, lambda eta to the fourth. And then for my theta, theta, and RR components, I've got a minus there, plus there, minus there, plus. And here I've got a plus, minus, minus, plus, same things. And then this is roughly zero. It's exactly zero in this limit in flat space. And so, once again, I've got a situation where my T perpendicular AB, as in they are the ones perpendicular to the vortex, are roughly zero, whereas the parallel components are proportional to the parallel part of the metric. So our candidate metric is going to, again, use our building blocks. In this case, I'm simply using a flat parallel metric. So using the same sort of principles as I've used with the wall, I notice that the trace of the energy momentum tensor is just twice T naught naught. And so this is essentially zero, whereas both of these are roughly equal and are proportional to minus epsilon lambda eta squared times, if I call T naught naught E. So what this is telling me is that A is just one, so I don't have any curvature parallel to my string. And in fact, C, my function C of R, is something that looks like one minus, I'll just tell you now because it's C So in vacuum, again, C double primed has to be zero, so it's just a function of R. But then if I integrate up my equations of motion, what I have is that, right, we've got C double prime being, again, negative, so that means my function is curving around. I know it's got to be proportional to R. So what that tells me is if I start off with it being exactly equal to R, which I have to for no singularity on the axis, then because C double prime is negative, I know it's got to curve away, so I'm kind of exaggerating here. And it does this in the region of the string core. And so what I get, again, it's the same sort of warp factor as with the A, but now this there is actually a theta direction. And so what I have is a conical space, but where the cone, the tip of the cone, is smoothed over by the core of the string. So this conical deficit, again, is something which, this is something with co-dimension two. You've got, you know, you've got the radial direction out and the angular direction around. And it's typical of, again, co-dimension two defects or brains that can crop up. Cosmic strings crop up as remnants of brain inflation, which is some particular idea, more recent idea of inflation coming from string theory. So they're something that can occur cosmologically. They're not a disaster. And so these two, well, both of these candidate metrics have applications in cosmology, but it's the string metric that's sort of got the most current interest. I shall have to stop now. Questions? Or are you just going to come back on the questions?